Welcome to Weekly Constitutional, a radio show where we discuss a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Boy, have we got a treat for you today. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a real event at the Appalachian School of Law, an event that we sponsored in conjunction with WETS, in conjunction with this radio show, in conjunction with our very good friends at Blue Ridge PBS. We had a community forum on prohibition, moonshining, and Central Appalachia. Why did we have this forum, you may ask? Well, it was to celebrate and to bring attention to the new, brand new Ken Burns documentary called Prohibition that's been broadcast this month, October of 2011, on PBS, including our good friends at Blue Ridge PBS. By the time you hear this broadcast, of course, you will have missed, if you haven't already seen it, you would have missed the original broadcast of Prohibition. But fear not, set your DVRs for early November. There will be a rebroadcast, and it's well worth watching. But as for right now, what you're going to hear for the next hour are excerpts from our community forum where more than 100 people from all over Grundy and Buchanan County and even all over Southwest Virginia came to the Appalachian School of Law. They enjoyed a light meal. They heard music by the ASL Jug Band. They even saw an explanation of a formerly working moonshine still, and then saw some excerpts from the show and then had a panel discussion on moonshining, prohibition, and Central Appalachia. The first voice you'll hear will be the Dean of the Appalachian School of Law, Wes Shin.
Welcome to the evening's program. Welcome to the Appalachian School of Law for those of you who are visiting for the first time. And let me turn the program over to our moderator for the evening, Professor Stuart Harris.
That's the only problem with our dean is that he's so long-winded. Thank you very much, Dean Shin. Thanks very much to all for coming. Again, welcome to everybody. Welcome students. Welcome visitors. Welcome our guests from the Mountain Mission School. Certainly welcome to all of our panelists and our guests from Blue Ridge PBS, who are co-sponsors here this evening for the show. I'll be introducing the panelists to you later, but they're going to sit out in the audience with you to begin with so that they can also enjoy the excerpts from the Ken Burns documentary, which we'll shortly be showing you. In fact, that's going to be the focal point of our evening because, of course, the reason we're all here is because this wonderful new documentary is going to be broadcast on our local PBS station, Blue Ridge PBS, which is Channel 47. On your cable dial. If you get DirecTV, it's also Channel 47. Excellent, wonderful, tremendous station, and an excellent, wonderful, tremendous documentary that's coming up. Steve Grieco, where are you? In the back here, Steve Grieco from Blue Ridge PBS called me up about, what, 4 or 5 months ago and said that he wanted to have a community forum here in the heart of Appalachia, here where moonshining has been a tradition for many years, here where prohibition is a very bad word. I agreed, and I'm very, very happy that we're able to put this together. As you can tell from looking at your program, in just a moment, just a couple minutes here, we will begin and look at some of these excerpts from the documentary, and then after that's over, we'll have a brief film produced by Blue Ridge PBS on local moonshining in this region. And then we'll have a panel discussion, and we'll discuss some of the ideas that are brought out in this documentary. I'll talk a little bit about the Constitution. We'll have some talk about moonshining in this region. We'll have some talk about modern-day prohibition. We'll have some talk about modern-day law enforcement of drug laws in this area from our various panelists. And then, of course, the most important part of the evening, we'll have some audience participation. So I'd like you to be thinking of whatever questions you have. You think of the hardest questions you can have for any of the panelists here. And then we will send my assistant, my secretary, Amy Owens, around with one of these microphones for you, and you will participate in this just as we are, because this is a community forum. It's for all of us to talk about these important issues, both historical and modern day. Now, before I go any further, let me introduce a representative from our co-sponsor this evening, Kate Foreman, the Vice President of Advancement for Blue Ridge PBS. Would you come on up and give us a couple remarks, please?
Hi. Thank you so much. On behalf of my colleagues at Blue Ridge PBS and the viewers that we serve in portions of five states, Virginia, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, North Carolina, it's my pleasure to acknowledge Dean Shin. Thank you again for agreeing to partner with us on this event. Professor Harris, who has done such incredible work on this, members of the faculty, members of the staff that are here tonight, the proud students of the Appalachian School of Law. Yay! The Appalachian School of Law Jug Band. We cannot forget that. The members of our distinguished panel who will be on stage in a little bit helping get us started on what I'm sure will be an unforgettable evening. Welcome. Thank you for being here. It's a great privilege for us to be here. Anytime there's a Ken Burns series that comes to public television, it's a very big deal for us. And we wanted to make sure that whatever we did in relationship to that really went to the right place. Tonight, this is the only event we are hosting in our five-state area that is having a prohibition screening. So we felt it was just a perfect match with the law school because the law matters in this issue. The history of the proud history of moonshining matters also. That's part of our culture as well. And we wanted to work with an institution where we knew that people cared about students and education. So again, we're just thrilled to be here with all of you tonight. We also want to recognize our media partner, WETS, the proud public radio station out of Johnson City, and your weekly constitutional, hosted by Stuart Harris. They've done a great job with marketing for this event. And because you can learn further that these things don't happen by magic, one of the reasons we're able to do this is because our station was awarded a grant from WETA. That's the public television station in Arlington, Virginia, that serves the Washington, D.C. area. They're the station that makes Ken Burns documentaries available to other public television stations. So they help us offset some expenses, and we're very thrilled that we were going to be doing this here. I also want to thank the University of Virginia's College at Wise. They are underwriting the Prohibition series itself. So you're going to see that institution on our air with on-air credit when the series starts to air Sunday night at 8 o'clock. A couple of things about what we're about to show you. We've got really two types of productions we're bringing to you tonight. One of them was funded by the grant. We're going to show you something that's not going to be on television in the form that you see it. Our production team has recorded interviews with people in Franklin County, which is just southeast of Roanoke. Franklin County is known as the moonshine capital of the world, and is absolutely famous or notorious, depending on your perspective, for a history of moonshining there. We've been interviewing people. We've got six individuals that you're going to see tonight who have expertise in that area. One is a Duke University professor. One is a former ABC agent who busted a lot of stills. One of them is a reporter. One of them is the director of Blue Ridge Institute. In Ferrum, it goes on and on. But you'll see those. We're going to be having short productions on television in accompaniment with Prohibition, where you'll be able to see some more about the local history of the region.
Now it's time for a couple of audio excerpts from the videos that were shown at the Community Forum on Prohibition, but I got it backwards. The first voice you'll hear is from the locally produced video, and then we'll hear just a little bit from the Ken Burns special Prohibition.
Making of liquor has been handed down generation to generation from probably since the first white men got into this region. And the tradition came from Europe, it came over here with them, and it's continued on to this present day, and it's still handed down within families. And there are families that have special recipes and things that they like to keep for themselves, and it's something that the people have been proud of, because if you made a good product, people knew it.
Prohibition. It was meant to eradicate an evil. Instead, it would turn millions of law-abiding Americans into lawbreakers.
I want to watch the rest of it. Yeah, that's pretty good stuff, isn't it? Well, thanks very much to Blue Ridge PBS. Thank you, Kate, for bringing that marvelous series of excerpts from the show, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to set my TiVo, and I'm going to watch this entire series from start to finish. Prohibition is considered sort of a dead issue. It's historically interesting. Okay, fine, it was there. It's no longer there. Why study it?
Well, because it's fascinating and because it has a great deal of modern relevance, both in terms of constitutional law and, of course, policy. And I note that it's the only drug, alcohol is the only drug that has its own constitutional amendment. In fact, not just one, but two. So it is really a notable part of our constitutional history and well worth studying. Now, this will be familiar to most of you, but I'll just briefly state that, of course, our Constitution is the basic law of the land. It's very hard to amend it. As you just heard, it takes two-thirds of the House or Senate to propose an amendment. Now, there are other ways to do it, but it's very hard to get it to even to that point. Can you imagine two-thirds of the House and the Senate today agreeing on anything, let alone a constitutional amendment? That's extraordinary. And then three-quarters of the states have to ratify it, either through their legislatures or through state conventions. And again, can you imagine three-quarters of the states in this country? These days, it's 38 states. Agreeing on anything, let alone a constitutional amendment. So our Constitution's been very infrequently amended. It's only been amended 27 times in 224 years. Between 1913 and 1920, 7 years, 8 years if you count all of it, all those years, we had four amendments. We had the 16th Amendment, which established an income tax. You just heard about that. That was in 1913. Also in 1913, we had the 17th Amendment, which for the first time allowed us to directly elect our senators. Prior to that, state legislatures had picked our senators, but now we get to vote for them ourselves. And then you heard that in 1919, we had prohibition with the 18th Amendment. And then in 1920, women got the vote finally with the 19th Amendment. So four amendments in a seven-year span. We call this era the Progressive Era because it was a time of great ferment, a time of great reformist zeal. And that's the era that you want to understand. This is a special time in our history, in the first decade or two of the 20th century, when we did something four times that normally we might wait 40 or 50 or 60 years to do. They all happened at once, and prohibition was right in the middle of it. I'm not going to repeat what you just heard in the Ken Burns special. There was a confluence of all sorts of different interest groups, brought it all together. And I will just mention one thing that you heard of a fellow named Wayne Wheeler in the Ken Burns special. He was really the one person who took all these disparate groups, who took all this ferment, who harnessed this great reformist zeal and put it over the top. He was the great general of prohibition and was considered at this time in the 19-teens and 1920s to be the most powerful lobbyist in Washington, D.C. He was the guy who was described as sitting up in the gallery going up or down and senators and congressmen trembling lest they get his disfavor. Wayne Wheeler was perhaps the best political strategist in American history, which is, of course, why you've all heard of him. Nobody's heard of him, because just like Prohibition, Wayne Wheeler disappeared from American history. So if you've learned nothing else today, you've learned about Wayne Wheeler and how important he was. But things changed, and a mere 14 years, actually 13 years and 10 months, I think, after Prohibition was enacted, it was repealed in the 21st Amendment. So that's the question that the later part of the Ken Burns special will address. We haven't gotten to yet. I'll simply outline why that happened. First of all, Wheeler died. He died in 1927. It was actually bizarre, not just tragic, but bizarre. His wife and he were on vacation in Western Michigan, and she suddenly burst into the room and burst into flames. She had been standing next to a fire. The fire had caught onto her dress, and she burned alive right in front of him as he tried to put out the flames. I believe it was only 2 weeks later that he himself died. A bizarre and tragic ending to his life. So the great general was gone. Moreover, and more generally, prohibition simply did not work. It was expensive, and nobody wanted to pay for the enforcement. It led to all sorts of rampant crime, the rise of organized crime, the gangs of Chicago, for example. It led to corruption, in the court systems and the political system generally. And interestingly enough, and also significant constitutionally, it led to bigger and bigger and more intrusive federal governmental action. In fact, one case from this era, some of you have read in your criminal law class. Anyone here remember the Olmstead case, United States versus Olmstead? It was a case where the U.S. Supreme Court considered a brand new technology that was being used to find and convict bootleggers. It was called wiretapping. And when the Supreme Court considered whether wiretapping was constitutional, whether police could just listen in on your phone conversations, they said, no big deal. No big deal. Wiretapping was constitutional. Who needs a warrant? It's just like listening to a conversation on the street corner. It caused an uproar at the time. People didn't like the idea of the government listening to them. And eventually it was reversed, but not until 1967. In that Olmstead decision, there was a famous dissent by Justice Brandeis where he mentioned for the first time the right to be let alone, but that's a whole other story. I mention it simply to say there's a constitutional significance here that you may never even have thought of when it comes to prohibition. One other thing that was mentioned, just briefly, but you may not have noticed it, was apportionment. When they were trying to get prohibition, the pro-prohibition forces realized that the population shifts in the country were going to lead to changes in representation. Because we have a census every 10 years. Article 1, Section 2 says take a census every 10 years and then reapportion the Congress. They knew they had to do it before 1920 because they knew the cities were growing and that's where all the wets were. So they got it done before 1920. But this is the part you've never heard. After the 1920 census, they didn't reapportion Congress. It had never taken Congress more than about 10 months to react to a census and reapportion itself. They didn't do it. They simply took no action. Thank you, Wayne Wheeler. Congress was not reapportioned until 2 years after he died in 1929. It didn't even take effect until 1932. And guess what happened in 1932? Oh, yes. The Democrats won on a repeal platform. The Democrats, by this time, had decided they were going to be on the side of repeal. They had a very strong candidate. You may have heard of him. His name was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He trounced Herbert Hoover, mostly because of the Depression, but partly because the Democrats were in favor of repeal. There's a lesson from all of this, and I think it can be stated succinctly. The American experiment in self-government is still working, even though we occasionally do very stupid things. With that as the basic framework for the constitutional aspects of prohibition, I now am going to turn over our discussion to our three distinguished panelists. Let me just mention them one by one. I'll mention, first of all, Carl Mullins, who is a historian from the Brakes Interstate Park and whom you probably met already standing by that remarkable still out in the courtyard. Welcome, Mr. Mullins.
Thank you.
Just a second. The next speaker after Mr. Mullins will be Howard Woolridge from Citizens Opposed to Prohibition, and I'll introduce him at more length before he speaks, but welcome, Mr. Woolridge. And our third distinguished panelist is our own Commonwealth's attorney, Tamara Neo, who puts people behind bars every day and has perhaps some experiences of prosecuting such people that she will share with us this evening. Welcome, Tamara Neo. Mr. Mullins, I believe your microphone is on, so would you please share with us some of the stories and lore of prohibition and of moonshining in this region? Thank you.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, where we're hearing excerpts from the recent community forum at the Appalachian School of Law on moonshining, prohibition, and Central Appalachia. After the break, we'll hear from our panelists. Stay tuned. It's your weekly constitutional, and we're about to listen to stories about moonshining in Appalachia from someone who should know, Carl Mullins, the historian at Brakes Interstate Park.
I'll do my best. I appreciate your inviting me. First of all, I'm not a professional public speaker, so you'll have to excuse my accent. I don't try to be nobody but myself. So I'll tell you a story in my days of growing up. My brother and I come from a family of 10. They were 8 boys, and that was good for anybody that's making a living on a farm, because you had 8 boys to do the farm work. But my brother and I, back in those days, we didn't have the privilege of the things that children have today. In other words, we didn't even have the privilege of owning a bicycle. There was a family across the mountain from us that had an old bicycle. So we had a goat, a billy goat, and we worked up a trade between us. We said, we'll trade you this billy goat for that bicycle. Now, that made my mother real happy, because she really wanted to get rid of old Billy. Because every time she'd do the wash and hang her clothes out on the clothesline, Billy would take them down, and what he didn't eat, he tore all to pieces. So getting rid of Billy was right up her line. But the deal was that we had to take the goat to them. In other words, across the mountain. And so we put a leash on the goat, to make a long story short, and through the woods we went. And as we went along, we came up on a steel, and we knew whose it was. We'll not mention the family's name. And they had just made that night before, so they were probably at home sleeping it off, and they had just made a big batch, and they had pulled the slop plug from the pot. So the slop from moonshine is the residue that is left behind after that the moonshine has worked off and found its way into the bottles and the jugs. And so they would just pull the plug and let the slop run down through the woods. They'd let the animals of the woods, a lot of times livestock, they would, it's a good thing to fatten up pork and swine by. And I noticed the goat, he started lapping up this slop. And we said, well, just let him eat all he wants. Maybe he'll put a few pounds on him, he'll look better time we get over to where we're taking him to. But after a while, his legs began to tremble and shake, and he would look up and had a look in his eye that I'd never seen before in my life. And he began to bang. And I said, I believe that doggone goat's drunk. To make the point, that slop had a lot of alcohol in it, and that goat got drunk as a billy goat. He would go around the tree, and we'd have the leash, and if someone would have made a movie, it would have hit the big time, no doubt. And the only reason it didn't get away from him, so drunk he couldn't see it, he'd hit a tree and we'd catch up to it. So finally, eventually, we got it out of the woods, and there's a clearing. And we had seen, you know, on the little television that just came out, this is back in the late 40s and the 50s, and we'd seen when a person would get drunk, they'd take a pail of cold water and throw in him and wake him up, and there was a pond of water down there. And they said, well, we've got to, sober this goat up before we certainly can't take him in the condition that he's in now. So we just picked the goat up and we flopped him into the pond. Oh, he'd come out a bawling and a man and a bawling, and we did it about 3 times, and finally he came out up chucking and so forth. We waited around a little bit and we finally said, well, he's all right. And we took him down to the boys, made the exchange, got the old bicycle, never rode it 10 yards, because the chain was all to pieces and it was in worse shape than the goat was. So I don't know who came out on the better deal. So these were honest families. They had a reputation to build. And the production of good whiskey was passed down from generation to generation. That is something that's being lost today, because the generation that it's being passed to is not interested in the production of good china, although it's still made. And I will say this, of course you can't find it with a metal detector, but there's many of a gallon of moonshine still out in the woods somewhere in the Appalachian Plateau, hid many years ago, 50, 75 years ago from the revenuers. It's still out there today according to what type of a cork or lid that they used so it wouldn't have rusted off. And I heard just two or three years ago of a person running into, I believe it's 25 gallon that he found under an old rotten log. Probably had been there for 50 to 75 years. So these were honest church-going people. Prohibition certainly didn't help the case, but it added a large headache and caused more problems than it ever cured. It looks like my time is up. I hope and trust that I brought some light into the situation this evening, and if you would take home the stories of my doings in moonshine, and you know it's called mean whiskey, which is bad whiskey, made from car radiators. You know, when the mob came in and started doing it on a big scale, they went for the almighty dollar, and they didn't care how good that the product was. So it made many of a person sick, and it cost many of a lives. I think the same problem we're having in the drug situation today, in Southwest Virginia, all over the Appalachian Plateau. The stuff that they're putting in the meth labs that I understand and killing our young, not only our young people, but our older people also. So I appreciate your time, and it's been my pleasure to have spoken to you, and hope that I've put some insight into it. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
That was wonderful, Mr. Mullins. Thank you very much. We do appreciate that. Our next panelist is Howard Wooldrich. He was 18 years. He was a police officer in mid-Michigan. He retired as a detective. He's a graduate of Michigan State University. He speaks four languages plus horse. He is the first person in the 21st century to ride a horse coast to coast in both directions, Georgia to Oregon, Los Angeles to New York City. Due to his travels on horseback, he was made a fellow of the Royal Geographic Society. His horse is a lot of horse stuff in here. His horse is the first in the new century to write a book, Misty's Long Ride by Smooth Georgia Mist. He is one of the five founders of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. For the past 6 years, he has been the voice of law enforcement on Capitol Hill in opposition to modern prohibition, and he calls Fort Worth, Texas, his home. Welcome, Howard Wooldrich.
War on drugs. How's that working for you here in the Commonwealth?
Not good.
Is it reducing your crime?
No.
Rates of death?
No.
Disease?
No.
Is it keeping drugs and drug dealers away from young people, teenagers, middle schoolers? These are important questions to ask yourself, because this policy is costing the United States taxpayers this year roughly about $75 billion. And my profession has spent, since war was declared in 1971, about $1 trillion, that's T-Tom trillion dollars, on this modern drug prohibition. Now, the reason I'm here with you tonight, and not back in Texas with the horse I love so much, Misty, who carried me across America, is children and young people. You say, no, wait a minute. You young people have heard all your life that the reason these dangerous, even deadly drugs are illegal is because we've got to protect our kids from those same drugs. There are some things we're not considering in this equation, rarely mentioned by the prohibition crowd. Drug prohibition hurts our kids in a number of ways, but for me, three main reasons. Number one, job. The policy of drug prohibition creates a job option for young people to become drug dealers. According to the United States government today, a solid 900,000 teenagers are employed as drug dealers. Every day, two, three are shot somewhere in America. Every week, two, three, four are shot dead. In my world and the world of my groups, it is immoral for this nation to have a policy which generates a job option for kids, which at a minimum gets them sucked into a life of crime and at maximum causes their injury or death. Secondly, this policy is distracting my profession from our true mission, which is public safety. You've got us chasing Charlie Sheen, Rush Limbaugh, Willie Nelson, Michael Phelps, and who's suffering because of this? Young people. We have a problem in this country of pedophiles. You may have seen the program to catch a predator, and we are missing those pedophiles in chat rooms because we're flying around in helicopters looking for a green plant. We have one police officer in 14 in this country, full-time narcotics officers. Let alone, essentially, every patrol officer is a part-time narcotics officer. Every hour we spend flying around in a helicopter, we are missing the pedophiles who, as we speak, are making contact with 12, 13, and 14-year-old young people who eventually, a number will be raped and hurt because those kids will be able to meet in real life, as you may have seen on that TV show. And third, and a little bit less seriously, but you're the victims of this policy in that tuition in our nation's colleges have doubled, redoubled, and redoubled again because since 1980-ish, we've built 2 million prison beds. The money for these prison beds came almost exclusively out of the budgets and state governments for higher education. In light of a 3% inflation rate over the last 25 years, college tuition has been going up roughly 10% per year as a consequence of this policy to build all these prison beds. So those are your tuition is higher. So today across America, the average college graduate graduates with a debt of $28,000. You start life owning the equivalent of a couple of cars. Now, President Nixon declared this war back in 1971 before most of you were born. He promised us a drug-free America, except for obviously people like Charlie Sheen. Millionaires could afford drugs. Of course, as an old Greek philosopher once said, in war, truth is the first casualty. No less so here. Ladies and gentlemen, this has never been a war on drugs. This has been and always will be, until it's repealed, a war on people. The American people, we are at war with ourselves. Mm-hmm. I know that in no state in the country is there a kilo of cocaine doing a 20-year mandatory sentence. It is a human being. And of course, most of these people are people of color. It's simply a fact in terms of who's going to go to prison at the end of the day. It's mostly people of color. Now you got to ask yourself, we've been at this for 40 years. We've arrested millions and millions of drug dealers. We've filled up hundreds of warehouses full of narcotics. So why are drugs so available to our young people at reduced prices and increased purity? Understand some things about drug dealers are the greatest single evil in America today, my opinion, in terms of a factor in our society. Why are they still out there? Something my profession will not tell you, but you know this kind of already. Drug dealers accept as a condition of employment death. Death and long prison terms are what drug dealers accept, and we know that there's always been someone stupid enough, desperate enough, or greedy enough to become a drug dealer. And if you want some graphic illustration of this, look at Mexico today. 4 years, 40,000 dead Mexicans, 90% of which are drug dealers, and there's always someone taking their place just like that. Now, you read about the, you know what we were supposed to do, create this drug-free America. And one thing you read in the paper and you see on the news all the time are the unintended consequences of this policy. Going back to the film you saw earlier, until 1919, if you watch old westerns, women did not go into saloons. Essentially, in America, women did not drink. But by the time Prohibition ended in 1933, many women were going into the speakeasies, and women were drinking in nearly the same numbers as men, another unintended consequence. What about this prohibition? You heard that we got the meth lab out there. Certainly the meth lab is the moonshine still of the 21st century. This morning, thousands and thousands of young American boys and girls woke up and had Cheerios at the same table that their parents the night before were making meth. How is that good for kids? How's that good for kids? Most of us, all of us here are patriotic. We all think as often as we can about the brave men and women fighting in Afghanistan for our freedom. And what do you also know? And this is from the United States Army War College report, not somebody from the reform movement, that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, 70% of their operating budget is provided by helping out the drug trade. So when you read of 100 of our brave men and women getting killed in Afghanistan, you can go to bed tonight knowing 70% are dying because of our policy of prohibition. Last year, Afghanistan overtook Morocco as the number one export of hashish. Hashish being concentrated marijuana. So the men and women we love, keeping us safe, and our policy of prohibition gets 7 out of 10 killed. Today we have about 2.3 million people in prison. We have 7 million in the system. We're the greatest incarcerator of people anywhere in the world, both in raw numbers and per capita. Now you got to ask yourself, do you feel proud of that particular statistic, being number one? Do you think it's because police officers and judges and prosecutors are so fantastic at their job that we've arrested so many people and put them behind bars? Or is that something that gives you pause and say, wait a minute, in the land of the free and the brave, we're the greatest incarcerator of people in the world? And of course, our inner cities are a war zone and have been for 40 years. Where the pop, pop, pop of a 9mm is going off on a regular basis to the point that you cannot get people to invest in the inner city. I've talked to specialists who work trying to bring jobs to the inner city, and they have told me it's almost impossible to get an employer to relocate into the inner city because of the crime issue. And that's a direct result, of course, of prohibition. And for those in the audience too young, 20, 25 years ago, 100,000 Colombians died for our cocaine prohibition. Today, you've read about, of course, the Mexicans have lost 40,000, 10% of which are innocent men, women, and children. And all of you, I am positive, feel very badly when you read about the fact a year or so ago, 15 teenagers were shot dead at a birthday party. We all felt bad. But this country did not feel bad enough to end the prohibition which got those children killed. And I could go on as far as unintended consequences. Let's go forward. Folks, we're in a bad economic situation. The thin blue line, the police across this country are getting thinner. You got to ask yourself, where do you want us to go? Because we are getting thinner, and that's not going to change. Does anybody out there think that the government can fix stupid? Anybody? Through the police department? No. 18 years as a street cop, I learned my profession cannot fix stupid. We pick up the pieces of stupidity, but we cannot fix stupid. And you have to make a decision. Do we return my profession to its true mission of public safety? Or do you want us to continue to try to save the likes of a Charlie Sheen, a Rush Limbaugh, from putting something in their body which arguably hurts only themselves? It was my experience that the war on drugs was the most destructive, dysfunctional, and immoral policy, since slavery and Jim Crow. It's time to let it go. I would like to thank the Appalachian School of Law for the opportunity to speak to you today. I look forward to your questions.
It's your weekly constitutional where we're listening to excerpts from the recent community forum on prohibition, moonshining, and Central Appalachia. You've just heard from Howard Wooldridge of Citizens Opposed to Prohibition. After the break, we'll talk to Commonwealth's attorney Tamara Neo, who has some different opinions. Stay tuned.
The very next day, we picked a bunch of them weeds and we put them in the sun to dry. And we mashed them up and cleaned them off. Put them in the corn cob pipe. Smoking them wildwood flowers got to be a habit. We never seen no harm. Oh, we thought it was kind of handy. Take a trip and never leave the farm. They go puff that wildwood weed. Next thing you know, you're just wandering around behind the little animals.
It's your weekly constitutional, and we're listening to excerpts from our recent community forum on prohibition, moonshining, and Central Appalachia. Next, we're going to hear from Tamara Neo, the Commonwealth's attorney for Buchanan County, Virginia, and she's going to tell us what she thinks about modern-day drug prohibition.
And now we have someone who's on the front lines every day here in Southwest Virginia, and she has the difficult task of enforcing all of our criminal laws, including our drug laws. Her name is Tamara Neo. She has been our Commonwealth's attorney, 4 years now?
It'll be 4 years this January.
4 years this January, and she is right across the street, and she employs many of our students. With the go over, and I think several of you would be either intern there or will intern there. And Tamara was out of town today, and so she arrived only shortly before we began, and so I didn't get a bio from you. Is there anything you'd care to add about your background? I'll let you tell anything more about yourself you want to say, but without further ado, Tamara Neo.
I'm a graduate of the University of Colorado School of Law at Boulder, and I also have a master's in public administration from the University of Colorado at Denver. I got my undergraduate degree at Rice University. So I've lived a lot of different places, and I didn't expect to have to take the conservative, stance, but I have to comment on a couple of the things that I heard this evening, and then I'm going to get into the meat of this as quickly as I can because I want to get back to the goat stories. First of all, what I am about to tell you is very limited. It is limited to Appalachia, and even within Appalachia, it's limited to Buchanan County. But I know Buchanan County, and I can tell you, Buchanan County is different than Texas. Buchanan County is different than Colorado, and Buchanan County is different than many places across the United States. So perhaps what you propose as policy at a national level would be detrimental in this community. It absolutely would. At the same time, I don't know an officer anywhere in Buchanan County that gives a hoot what Charlie Sheen does. They're interested in making sure that the children of Buchanan County grow up in circumstances, and I see my CASA worker over there nodding, grow up in circumstances that right now are accepted and aren't right. It isn't right for children to grow up with meth being made on the table. Fortunately, Buchanan County does not have a big methamphetamine problem. We have a prescription narcotic problem, like unlike any other region I come across within the Commonwealth. Let's see, what else? You said that it was people of color that are being locked up, and I would disagree with that. It is people of poverty that are being locked up. And in Appalachia, that color is white. I think that's the bigger issue to deal with there. And with regards to going out and getting pedophiles, you know, that's such a buzzy term for selling an idea. And I don't mean to be too critical, especially to another law enforcement officer, but to me, I don't have a rape case or really even a pedophile case where there wasn't alcohol or drugs or some sort of an altered state involved first. So to me, it's a precursor. I don't have an addict that I know that didn't begin with marijuana at a ridiculously young age. So, you know, I feel a little awkward because I do have a libertarian streak in me. Figure, you know, you do what you want, just don't send me the bill. But at the same time, that's not what's happening. That isn't what's happening. We are paying the bill for people who are doing this. And that's why in this country we lock people up, because we do want our freedoms. We want freedoms from people who otherwise would interfere with them, who aren't playing fair in the, you know, do what you want, just don't send me the bill concept. So, let's see. Mr. Mullins said something that absolutely touched my heart, and I think really brings home what the difference is for me between what I hear of prohibition times and what I see in modern day and drug culture. He said that these were honest families, and he said that many of them made it but never touched a drop. And it's different now. It's different. When I find an addict, they are usually not the big fish. The big fish is somebody who doesn't use, doesn't touch a drop or a pill, but uses addicts to sell for them, which to me is corrupt. It's corrupting the soul. They're using someone else's weakness to further a product. So I think it may have been there, perhaps there was a time, but that same analogy of honest families doesn't apply anymore. Now our big fish are families. They're families who gather up every daughter, son, cousin, nephew, whatever, load them into a van, travel to Florida, North Carolina, Northern Virginia, and falsify medical records, go to a doctor who could care less what they were bringing in anyways, and start writing prescriptions for massive quantities of drugs that should have never been combined in the first place and aren't really even treating what's being proposed. That's the problem in Buchanan County. In 2010, we put through more than 1,300 indictments in circuit court. So that's not the lower courts, not the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, not the General District Court, where people would report things to law enforcement or to a magistrate. That's me knowing something and bringing it forward. Some of it may have begun down below, some of it came through other sources, but that's me writing an indictment and taking it to the grand jury. There were over 1,300. I was writing a grant, preparing to write a grant. And as part of that process, I went through every single indictment. I wanted to know how many of them were related to drugs or alcohol. Of that 1,300, 89% were either a drug charge or something immediately or indirectly related to a drug charge. Somebody's writing a check because they're trying to feed their habit. Somebody's stealing something because they're trying to feed their habit. Somebody's selling drugs. 89%. When I factored in alcohol, we got only up to 95%, which is astounding when you think about it. If we could eliminate prescription narcotics and the other surrounding drugs, most of this community's crime would disappear. Disappear. I think the thought I want to leave with you is, and I've heard it, are the drug dealers that I see, are they modern producers and bootleggers? I've heard that more than once. Well, I'm just selling a pill like my granddaddy sold gin or whatever it was. And I don't have the answer. I think we're dealing with a coin. I think that it is full of issues on both sides. To me, based on seeing an overdose no less than once every 6 weeks, and some come in strings of 3 and 5. We had one yesterday morning. For me, seeing as many overdoses as I see, it's not even close. It's not even close. It's not man-made. There's nothing into it that could went into it other than lying to a doctor and finding a doctor who was more interested in getting money than being of use and helping. Marijuana,
I don't know, man, Appalachia would be a very wealthy little area if marijuana was suddenly legalized. But again, I'll come back to the fact that I don't see an addict where marijuana wasn't the first substance they were trying at 8 or 9 or 10. And that would be my biggest concerns. So with that, I want to put the microphone down and get to more goat stories.
Thanks very much to Tamara Neal, our Commonwealth's attorney, and to the other panelists. Now we come to the funnest part of the evening, and the funnest part is where you get to talk.
I'd just like to thank you, first and foremost, for a very informative discussion. And I guess I'd like to direct this question to Mr. Woolridge. Would your answer to Ms. Neal be that if you remove the financial, remove the money incentive out of the dealing aspect, that addiction, whether it be Buchanan County or elsewhere, would go down because you have less people pushing? That's maybe part A. And then part B would be, since she enumerated that the biggest issue here is actually prescription drugs, does that really touch that? And maybe, so if maybe both of you want to speak to that.
Well, let me, thank you for the question. Let me just, two quick points Ms. Neal was talking about. One, according to all government surveys, the first illegal drug a young person tries is tobacco. Mm-hmm. The second illegal drug a young person tries is alcohol. And the third drug a young person tries is marijuana. The good news is, and this is something that we lose sight of in law enforcement, because we only see the problems. You don't call 911 when life is fine. According to the last government survey, for 100 people starting marijuana today, 72 never go past it. And then at the end of the cycle, between 1 and 2% become addicted to cocaine or a harder drug. And secondly, in terms of if we can make this go away, folks, we've been at this for 40 years and $1 trillion. And if I could have a big red button to push and make all of these drugs go away except for the medicinal use of marijuana, I would do it in a heartbeat. But folks, we've been pushing on the big red button for 40 years and $1 trillion. You want to go for another trillion? And short our colleges, et cetera. In answer to your question, certainly this is all money driven. Cocaine legally would cost an addict about $3 to $5 a day. Heroin, a little bit less. Amphetamines, etc. These drugs are only astronomical because of they're illegal. A crackhead needs $200 a day to support their habit. They have to create just a touch more than one felony per day. So who's thinking about the hundreds of thousands of good American citizens out there who are crime victims every day because some crackhead needs $200 a day as opposed to three? Certainly we would have, if these drugs were, and just to be clear, in my world, as a starting point for discussion, I would give all these dangerous and deadly drugs the same rules and regulations as the nation's second deadliest drug, alcohol. Of course, the first one being tobacco. As we sit here tonight and talk about all the tragedies and the deaths, and I've been to the people who died of overdoses, I also know that every day in America, 4 young people die of alcohol overdose. We have to think about, of course, one, the crime victims, and secondly, as I said, we can't fix stupid. So no matter what, we are a mosquito in the butt of an elephant. We make a 0.0 difference on this issue. We would have zero dealers in America, as we have essentially zero moonshiners today. Does that take care of it? Thank you.
You're just asking for a response. I guess I would point to methadone. Methadone is a legally prescribed cheap drug right now. And I know that I regularly see overdoses from it, and I regularly see accidents that kill motorists from it. Mm-hmm. It's legal, it's prescribed, and it's cheap.
This question goes to Mr. Woolridge. Your position to decriminalize drugs, does that make them legal to produce and sell? So, say I could go into the liquor store and buy a box with a syringe full of heroin. I don't see how that would solve the epidemic. It might empty out the court dockets and the jails, and it seems like it would fill up the funeral home. You say more people die of tobacco and alcohol because more people use them. If you legalize and can go buy heroin off the street, I don't see how that would it would increase that as well.
Thank you for the question. Certainly, in my world, there's a decrim would not get rid of the drug dealer. I've dedicated the rest of my life, if necessary, to getting rid of what I consider the greatest evil in America, and that's the street-level drug dealer. The only way you can do that is to treat these drugs legally, regulated, and perhaps taxed. In terms of buying a box of heroin-filled syringes, go back to a 1910 Sears Roebuck catalog, sir, and you will find syringes, and you could legally buy heroin. So until 1914, when this prohibition got going for the harder the drugs besides alcohol, you could go to the pharmacy and buy all the heroin and cocaine, etc. you wanted to without a prescription, and you went home and you were an addict. And if you had a drug problem, you saw a doctor, or you suffered and died, same as they do today with tobacco. And the last part of your question is, you have to ask yourself, how many people? The idea is, if you make it legal and regulated, how many more people will start using the heroin, the crack, the meth? I can tell you there's been no government survey or research ever done. The government does not want to know. It's willfully being ignorant of how many of us would start using heroin, etc., or even if, whether adult or non-adult. I've talked to 8 doctors, board certified in addiction psychology. All 8 have said, for the hard drugs, they expect to have essentially zero change. Who in this room, show of hands, if heroin were legal and you could buy it in the Sears Roebuck catalog with a syringe, how many of you out here would start taking heroin who aren't using it today? How about crack? Meth? Thank you. And you know what? You're just average. If you don't smoke cigarettes by the time you're this age, I could offer you $10 a pack to smoke them, and you wouldn't do it because you're not that stupid. Be careful of thinking millions of Americans are out there that are so stupid that if you make crack legal, they'll start using it. Now, the prohibition crowd tells us that all the time because that's the only thing they got left in their quiver, is to say millions of us will start using crack, meth, and heroin. It'll be the destruction of American society. Same as you always hear that the first drug every addict tries is marijuana. That's illegal, and of course, that's not true.
I got to add something to that. I'd like, and I won't ask for a show of hands, but within your own minds, I want you to think for a second. I want you to think backwards to when you were wherever you were and you had marijuana for the first time, or you had alcohol for the first time. If somebody in that moment of reverie and being cool and being with your friends had handed you something else, within your own mind, how many of you would have said, "Yeah," or how many of you would have said, "Well, so and so did it. I'm just curious. I want to try it." I think that's a different question with a very different answer.
Now, Mr. Mullins, you're caught between a lawyer and an activist, and I just get this sense, and one of them's actually stolen your microphone. Do you have anything you'd care to add here?
I'd like to add that I think that the what is needed is to get back to a basic family and education. The family values that's gotten away from this nation. Whereas God-fearing people, or however you want to put it, but I feel like that education is the main, and it starts at home.
And so Carl Mullins of Brakes Interstate Park gets the last word at our community forum on prohibition, moonshining, and Central Appalachia. Thanks very much to all of our panelists, including Mr. Mullins, Howard Wooldridge, and Tamara Neo. My name is Stuart Harris. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.